If your New Year's resolutions to eat better, be healthier, and shed a few pounds haven't quite panned out yet, here's a strategy you may not have considered: intermittent fasting. NPR's Allison Aubrey is here to talk about an approach that's gaining a lot of traction among dieters and researchers who are studying the possible benefits beyond just weight loss. And Allison, intermittent fasting gives us a sense of what it is, fasting every now and then?
Right. Well, the idea here is not to starve yourself for days. I like to think of this more as a mini fast where you go, say, a 14 to 18 hour stretch without eating one or two days a week. The most well-known plan out there is called the 5-2 diet, popularized by a British physician. And this is where you eat normally for 5 days out of the week, and then you pick 2 days a week when you do a mini fast. So, for example, you have an early dinner around 5 p.m., and you don't eat again until breakfast the next day at 8. That means you've done a 15-hour mini fast. And the aim is that on these 2 days, you cut way back on the number of calories that you're eating to just 500 or 600 calories a day.
And that's the catch.
That's right. That's the catch.
And Allison, you've been trying this intermittent fasting. You have a lean and hungry look to me. How's it going?
Well, you know, since this has been generating so much interest among scientists over in the UK and here, I decided, hey, why not? I'll try it. Not so much for weight loss, but for other possible benefits, such as lowering blood sugar and increasing energy and focus. That sounds good, right?
Yeah, sure.
And I have to say, it is challenging. I won't eat anything after 5 o'clock, so that means I'm at home cooking for my children, not eating dinner, and don't eat again until the next morning. So it can be challenging when you get started.
Yeah, 600 calories doesn't give you a lot of flexibility. What are you trying to eat on those days?
Right. Well, you know, you can eat what you like, but to be realistic, if you're down to 500 calories, these calories have got to hold you. So you're basically eating a lot of lean protein, greens, other non-starchy vegetables. And the important part here is to go that long stretch of at least 15 hours without eating.
Any downsides, Allison, besides crankiness, as I imagine, people for whom intermittent fasting is a really bad idea, maybe?
So I think that there are any number of people who probably wouldn't want to try it, pregnant women, children. If this is something that you're interested in and you have hesitations, certainly talk to your doctor.
Why do this, though, Allison? Why not just reduce intake throughout the week?
Well, you know, this is where the science really gets interesting. Researchers at the University of Manchester in the UK tested this diet approach in about 100 women. Half of the women in the group went on this 5-2 diet. The other half followed a more traditional low-fat diet where they tried to restrict calories 7 days a week. And what the researchers found is that the 5-2 dieters lost more weight, they lost more body fat compared to the women on the traditional low-fat diet. So this was a surprise. And what's more, the women on the 5-2 diet also saw improvements to blood sugar. So the researchers are still trying to untangle why this seems to be the more effective dieting strategy. But one thing I can say from my own experience is that these mini fasts really seem to cut the appetite, or at least my appetite. One of the first days I tried this, I was really hungry when I was going to sleep.
Yeah.
And I literally fell asleep, like dreaming of a chocolate croissant. I was even planning my trip over to Union Station in the morning to buy my chocolate croissant. But when I woke up, I did not even want it. I think I had oatmeal instead, and I left half of the oatmeal in the bowl uneaten. So scientists say this pattern of eating may help regulate appetite so we don't eat as much.
Well, apart from appetite, Allison, you said you were interested in the effects of fasting on energy and on focus. What's known about how intermittent fasting might affect those?
Sure. Well, one of the scientists that I've been talking to is Mark Mattson at the National Institute on Aging. And he says fasting brings a lot of changes in body and brain chemistry. His studies in animals, mainly mice, find that going without food can change the way the brain gets energy. So he's studying how this affects learning and memory. And he's actually planning a study in people later this year. Researchers are also interested in immunity. It turns out that fasting seems to put a mild stress on the cells in the body. And again, studies in animals suggest that the cells become more resilient and better able to protect against damage and disease. So as Mattson likes to point out, you know, this eating 3 square meals a day plus a few snacks, as is so typical of modern life, is very abnormal from an evolutionary perspective. Humans have, in fact, fasted intermittently for most of history, and perhaps there's a benefit to this.
NPR food and health correspondent and intermittent faster, Allison
right.
Aubrey. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Melissa.
And for a look at reaction here in the U.S. and some other domestic political news, we turn now to Cokie Roberts, as we do most Mondays. Good morning.
Hi, Renee.
So Congress is soon scheduled to vote on funding for the Department of Homeland Security. It's part of an ongoing debate with the Obama administration about immigration. What's likely to happen now on what some Republicans were hoping to be a showdown vote against the president?
Well, it's bad timing, isn't it? And listening to Republican leaders yesterday, I think not much is going to happen. They're likely to give the department what it wants and not make those cuts in the TSA that had been proposed. It was always, look, a bad idea from the Republican standpoint. You had in the exit polls from the last election, 72% of the people saying that they're worried about a terrorist attack. I suppose if you had taken that same poll any time over the last few days, listening to our law enforcement and military officers, it would be closer to 100% worried about these attacks. The American officials, starting with Eric Holder in Paris, have made it very clear that these so-called sleeper cells are terrifying them. They don't know who's training in Yemen and especially in Syria, so they don't even know who to put on the no-fly list. And it's very clear that these trained operatives are very, very scary. So it'll be interesting to see how the Republicans deal with this if they really want to make their point on immigration on a bill that deals with all of security.
Well, also a security issue that almost got lost this past week in the horrors that happened in Paris is cybersecurity. Yesterday, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Martin Dempsey, was not exactly encouraging.
No, to put it mildly. And, you know, we've just seen the Sony hacking, and lots of experts said then, look, this was a movie studio, so it wasn't so terribly important, but other institutions could be very dangerous. And the chairman of the Joint Chiefs said yesterday that while the U.S. has military superiority in almost every aspect, that we have, quote, peer competitors in the cyber area. And he said cyber terrorists can, quote, destroy hardware and disable critical infrastructure. So there's a big sense of threats out there. Both the president and the vice president are doing cyber events this week, calling for collaboration between industry and government on cybersecurity and proposing legislation to protect individual security. But, you know, what happens is that American politics changes. The focus of what people are concerned about changes, and it can change overnight. And that's what we're seeing right now. We're dealing with a new concern in politics, and if personal safety is at issue, it becomes, Renee, the only concern. And I think that that is what the leaders are dealing with now.
Cokie Roberts joined us most Mondays on Morning Edition. Thanks so much.
Mm-hmm.
Here's a question for you. Do you have enough time to be bored anymore, as in mental downtime? Now, if you have a smartphone, you already know what I'm getting at. Many of us reflexively grab our phones at the first hint of boredom, say during our commute, like these people we found waiting for metro trains here in Washington, D.C.
You caught me red-handed.
Well, I know I stay on my phone all day. I know I would do more things, but I stay on my phone all day from the time, like, I got off this morning. And I've been on my phone since I got off.
That's Sabrina Jackson of Washington and Jonathan McBride of Lima, Peru. A study done by the research group Flurry found that mobile consumers now spend an average of 2 hours and 57 minutes each day on mobile devices. So are we packing our minds too full? What's lost with all this texting, tweeting, email checking? Well, our friend Manoush Zomorodi, host of WNYC's podcast New Tech City, is digging into that question, and she joins us to talk about her reporting for a project called Bored and Brilliant, The Lost Art of Spacing Out. Hey there, Manoush.
Hi, Audie.
So you call yourself a skeptical technophile, right?
Yes.
And I mean, I have a smartphone, you have a smartphone, and I assume that you're on yours all the time, right?
You know, it's gotten so bad that I actually downloaded an app, and it's called Moment, and it can measure not only how much time you spend on your phone, but how many times you check it. And I'm ashamed to say that I am averaging between 50 and 100 check-ins a day. And, you know, it's
Whoa.
Not just because, yeah, it's a lot.
I'd make fun of you, but mine would probably be the same.
Well, yeah, tell me about your relationship with your phone, Audie.
It's a love-hate relationship. I just try not to sleep with it under the pillow at this point.
Yeah, so for me, I kind of realized that I have not been bored since I got a smartphone 7 years ago. And recently, another admission here, it's gotten particularly bad because I've become one of those people who cannot stop playing a game. And my addiction is a game called Two Dots. If you ride the subway in New York City, everyone is playing it.
Well, the thing is, a lot of times when we're checking our phones, right, it's time when we would have spaced out anyway, in the elevator, in a checkout line.
Yeah.
Are we really losing anything here? I mean, what have you learned about the importance of time to be bored?
Well, what I've learned is that our brains are doing some really important work when we think we're doing nothing. So research suggests we get our most original ideas when we stop the constant stimulation and we let ourselves get bored. So one of the researchers I spoke to for the project is a psychologist named Dr. Sandy Mann at the University of Central Lancashire in the UK. And she actually tested for the connection between boredom and creativity. She did an experiment where she made people do something really boring and then try a creative task. This was a little test she came up with. And the participants came up with their most novel ideas when they did the most boring task of all, which was reading the phone book. And in fact, she is on a mission to bring back boredom. Here's why.
When we're bored, we're searching for something to stimulate us. So we might go off in our heads to try and find that stimulation by our minds wandering, daydreaming. And you start thinking a little bit beyond the conscious, a little bit into the subconscious, which allows sort of different connections to take place.
So there's value in being bored, but do we really know if the use of smartphones is affecting that?
Well, that's the big question, right? In the last decade or so, neuroscientists they've really started to understand what they call mind wandering and how it leads to daydreaming, which is actually the brain's default mode. And that phrase, default mode, was first used by Dr. Marcus Reichel in 2001 to describe the brain's resting function. We go to that place naturally. So psychologists and neuroscientists have only just started to study what the consequences could be of disrupting that rest function. One thing they do worry is that smartphones could be keeping us from doing something called autobiographical planning, and that is goal setting.
All right. Well, remember those smartphone users we talked about earlier? We actually put this idea to them about, you know, whether it might be better just to put the thing down. Here's what they said.
Better to be bored?
I don't know if I agree with that. I think it's a combination of both is good. I think some free time is good, but I also think the brain needs to be engaged and active.
I would agree that boredom is a good thing. I think lack of nothing to do in your hands or in front of you gives your brain some space to think.
Washington, D.C. subway riders using their smartphones on the platform. That was Joe Meehan of Arlington, Virginia, Adrian Fielding of Silver Spring, Maryland, and Manoush on New Tech City this week. You are challenging people to think about this, to rediscover the lost art of spacing out. How?
So, Audie, we've come up with some ways that people can find the right balance for them with their tech usage. First, what we're going to do is get a baseline. We're partnering with that app that I mentioned that's called Moment that measures how many times a day we pick up our phones and how many minutes we use on our phones. We're just seeing where do things stand now and where could some changes take place.
Explain how this is going to work.
Okay, so Bored and Brilliant, it's this one-week challenge. It's going to happen the first week of February, but you can sign up right now, start observing your own phone behavior, and get ready to rethink it.
Manoush, thanks so much for talking with us, and I guess we'll see you in a few weeks.
I'm looking forward to it, Audie.
That's Manoush Zomorodi, host of the podcast New Tech City from our member station WNYC, talking about her show this week. You can find details at the All Tech Considered blog on NPR.org. In fact, some of us here at ATC are going to try to cut our own phone usage, and we'll have Manoush back next month to see how it went.
Iowa's biggest city is confronting the farms that surround it over water pollution. The Des Moines Water Works has announced it will sue three neighboring counties, claiming the counties are letting fertilizer runoff contaminate the drinking water in Des Moines. It is a novel attempt to control water pollution from farms, something that has been largely unregulated. NPR's Dan Charles reports.
The city of Des Moines gets its water from two rivers, the Raccoon River and the Des Moines, and those rivers have a problem. Bill Stowe, general manager of the Des Moines Water Works, told Iowa Public Radio that the water often violates legal limits for a pollutant called nitrate.
we're still seeing the public water supply in central Iowa directly risked by high nitrate concentrations.
Too much nitrate can be a health risk, especially for infants just a few months old, and it costs a lot of money to remove. Filtering out nitrate cost the Des Moines Water Works almost $1 million in 2013. And Stowe says, we know where a lot of this nitrate is coming from.
We've been in northern Iowa with our lab personnel testing water.
The problem comes from farms, he says. Farmers spread nitrogen fertilizer on their corn fields. It turns into nitrate, and then it often runs into streams through networks of underground tile pipes that drain the soil. Those drainage systems are managed, in some cases, by county governments.
When they build these artificial drainage districts that take water quickly into the Raccoon River, polluted water, they have a responsibility to us and others as downstream users.
Stowe's agency announced last week it intends to sue three upstream counties that manage those drainage systems.
We need to get now down to specific improvements that they're willing to make. If they're not willing to make that, we'll see them in federal court.
Fertilizer runoff affects a lot more than just drinking water. It's been killing off webs of aquatic life from small Midwestern lakes to the Gulf of Mexico. And lots of programs have been set up to try to solve the problem. Scientists have created tools to help farmers minimize their use of fertilizer. John Downing, an ecologist at Iowa State University, says farmers can also build sediment-trapping ponds or create wetlands to capture water from those drainage systems. That can be costly, though.
You'd have to take land out of production. And if you look at the prices of land in agricultural production areas, it's very pricey.
So state and federal governments have been offering financial incentives, paying farmers to build those pollution traps on their land. Dan Hanrahan, a farmer in Madison County, Iowa, who's on a local committee that reviews soil and water conservation projects, says these programs are popular.
We've got over a two-year waiting list of people wanting to put practices in place.
He says these cooperative, voluntary efforts have accomplished more than litigation ever will. Yet the problem of nitrate pollution has not gone away, and the Des Moines Water Works is saying it's time to take a harder line. Dan Charles, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Ty Siegel is 27 years old, and he does it all. Writes, sings, produces, plays guitar and drums. He's released a large amount of music over the past decade, solo albums as well as working with other bands. Rock critic Ken Tucker is going to review Siegel's new four-song EP, Mr. Face, and try to get a fix on Siegel's recent productivity.
Sometimes I feel as though I almost owe Ty Siegel an apology. The kid has released an album a year for the past 7 years, put out numerous singles, EPs, even cassettes of new music. This, in addition to performing as part or most of at least six other bands, including Fuzz and the Epsilons. All this work, and I've never reviewed a Ty Siegel project here. As a kind of New Year's resolution, I told myself I'd tackle the next thing Siegel released. And that turned out to be Mr. Face, a four-song EP that's a terrific showcase for Siegel's artfully ragged style. He plays everything on these recordings with the exception of one drum part on one song. Siegel is deeply influenced by music recorded before he was born or when he was very young. He has cited as influences everyone from the Grateful Dead to the Velvet Underground to Kiss. He uses the phrase super noisy to characterize some of his best music, which partakes of the bash-it-out philosophy of 60s garage rock and 70s punk. A song on the new EP called Circles begins with a 30-second drum solo, followed by a song that achieves maximum intensity right from the start of Siegel's vocal. The entire song is a plaintive wail about the difficulties of a relationship based on endless analyzing of the relationship. Knows how to have fun. The Mr. Face EP comes on 2 7-inch discs that double as a pair of 3D glasses. If you're looking to increase your Ty Siegel collection, I highly recommend his solo albums Manipulator and Twins, a compilation of non-album songs called Singles 2, and the Fuzz 2013 album. Sure, there's some self-indulgence in Siegel's work, and some repetition if you listen to big chunks of his discography. But self-indulgence in the service of creating the kind of passion produced when you pour out everything is a rewarding indulgence. And who besides a music critic re-listens to a half dozen albums by the same artist in one sitting? Siegel knows that's not how most people consume music. He knows that his listeners are looking for something fresh and new that nevertheless links up to a grand tradition of flat-out, revved-up rock and roll. And he gives it to them. He gives it to them a lot.
Ken Tucker is critic-at-large for Yahoo TV. He reviewed Ty Siegel's new 4-song EP called Mr. Face. If you'd like to catch up on interviews and reviews that you missed, or just listen on your own schedule, check out our podcast. It's easy to get on iTunes or on your phone app. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. I'm Terry Gross.
And a final thought on tech now from last week's International Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas. Commentator Judy Carter was there checking out gizmos with human relationships on her mind.
I was supposed to go to the show with my partner, but we had a fight. So I went alone, wondering if gadgets could help us. The first thing I see, a brain-sensing headband.
What it does is it senses the electronic signals coming from your brain.
Can it sense the brain activity of your husband or your wife?
No, and it doesn't necessarily read your brain. It just reads your brain activity.
Oh, well, I moved across the floor.
This is SoMake Technology?
Yes. They were just selling chargers for mobile phones.
I thought it was finding your soulmate, like dating, like getting married. No?
There are thousands of gadgets to recharge phones, but nothing to recharge relationships. Apparently, the most important relationship you have is with yourself. I don't need anybody as long as I have my own drone.
What does it say?
Taking your selfies to new heights. You throw your Xano up, you get a photo or a video of you in a location.
So you can take selfies of yourself now from the sky.
Yes, pretty much.
Probably a little more flattering.
Yeah.
The theme of CES, people don't need people, they need gadgets. Well, as I'm leaving, I look up and I see a big sign proclaiming the message of this conference. Break free of your attachments. Really? But I need attachments. Coming home, I realize that my partner does something that no gadget does. Makes me laugh. But hey, coming in 2016, the new gadget, laugh at that for all platforms. Uh-oh. Judy Carter for NPR News.